debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. America, north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America for the People. The official show of Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People, a 501c3 nonprofit whose educational mission is to let the people of America and people around the world know about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. We're going to be talking today about a topic that's always on the periphery of everything we talk about, or much of what we talk about, certainly with international issues, but most people don't talk about much, and that's the CIA. It's something most people don't know much about. I didn't know much about it until I started talking to my next guest, Carl Eisenbach, who's been on the show many times. He's educated himself over decades about the CIA, its history, how it works, and he's going to be talking to us today about whether it has any place in the modern world, if it ever did have any real justification. For those people who don't know, the CIA was founded in 1947 by an act of Congress at the request of President Truman, who wanted an intelligence agency that would be able to get foreign intelligence to him and present it to him in an unbiased manner to help determine national security decisions. Well, then they got the bright idea in 1948 that they needed to do more than that. They were afraid that the KGB was running around trying to subvert governments and whatnot, and so they figured they better be able to do that too. So they created this covert operations division of the CIA, and that's what we'll be talking mostly about today. And the covert operations branch was specifically designed to undermine governments in various ways. Eventually, it was used to actually stage guerrilla insurgencies, although that was illegal at first. It's been used for targeted assassinations and propaganda purposes that people really need to know about. So with no further ado, I'm going to be talking about this with Carl Eisenbach today. Hi, Carl. Thanks for being back on the show.
Good to be here.
Well, Do you want to talk at all about the origins of the CIA? Well, I guess we try to be balanced on the show, being as we are a 501c3 nonprofit. What were the arguments for creating the CIA in the first place? Do you think they were valid arguments?
Yeah, I think you have to put it into the context of what was happening after World War II. You know, basically, the Soviet Union really did start exhibiting aggressive behavior towards Western Europe, among other things, and so the threat of Nazism was quickly supplanted with the perceived threat of communism coming from the Soviet Union. And so Harry Truman and others had the idea of starting out at more or less dispassionate, centralized location for analyzing foreign intelligence, and that was how the CIA was formed. Now, you know, the one thing that happened, you know, very quickly after World War II was that one of the things was that fighting communism was seen as the predominant mission of the CIA and the intelligence communities. And so one of the first acts of the CIA was to establish an intelligence network that was actually supposedly based in Ukraine as a way of fomenting trouble for the Soviet Union. And only later did the agency discover that all their agents had not only been turned, you know, in terms of going and feeding the CIA false information, but they'd all been executed. And so the fight against communism went to France and Italy, where the Communist Party showed strong support in the presidential parliamentary elections. And this was the first time that the CIA actually made contact with the mafia. Lucky Luciano of the New York mob was granted immunity in terms of his ability to influence the Italian elections in the late 1940s. And so, you know, the mafia was more or less present at the creation of the CIA as a backdoor tool for doing things practically from the moment it was started.
Wasn't the Office of Strategic Services already working with the mafia during World War II?
Well, yes, it was, but you know, I mean, it was sort of in the context of the war effort as opposed to just sort of subverting government effort, I guess I would say that.
Well,
there really was a qualitative difference between the World War II operations and the post-war operations.
Well, I just want to say that I understand what you're saying, but it was also a seamless transition.
It was very easy, yes.
Yeah, one of the things we talk about on this show is how wars, even so-called just wars, are used to advance the interests of the very wealthy and corporate interests, you can say. So these are the powers. This is a point I wanted to get to pretty quick. These are the powers who were behind the formation of the CIA, which is an interesting story in itself. I mean, you've seen the movie The Good Shepherd, right, where they were recruiting in Ivy League colleges for people from upper class families who joined secret societies. That was prime recruiting ground for the CIA, similar societies were in Great Britain for MI6.
Right.
You want to comment on that at all?
Well, you know, I think the class component has always been sort of in with the CIA's creation from the very beginning. You know, it's sort of like a natural outcome of that intelligence operation. And of course, once you set something up like that, it sort of is imprinted onto the charactership of the institution forever from that point on in time. And it was a very short step, you know, from being in alliance with the Skull and Bone Society and the Ivy Leagues into hobnobbing with Standard Oil and the United Fruit Company, you know, in the successful overthrows of the Guatemalan and the Iranian governments.
Right. Now, let me just say, people, when you start talking about secret societies and whatnot, people roll their eyes and say you're a conspiracy nut. However, John F. Kennedy, who appears to have been the target of one of these conspiracies, he warned us about secret societies very publicly, didn't he?
I'm not familiar with Kennedy's, you know, quotes. So
he did give a speech on that. Yeah, you can Google it, JFK secret societies, and he was talking about the danger to democracy of having of the existence of these secret societies. And I used to wonder what the heck he's talking about. What, the Masons, the Illuminati? No, he's talking about these secret societies where people. Well, if you saw the movie The Good Shepherd, from what I understand, that's pretty accurate in terms of how they recruit. They take people, they make them tell their dirtiest secrets, and they swear them to secrecy, and so they've got something on them. And there's severe punishments for betraying secrecy. So there's a culture of secrecy there.
I kind of take it from a slightly different perspective, okay? And that is that I think way too often, you know, conspiracy theories are a popular way of thinking to try and have people explain the way the world works. And in fact, what I contend is that conspiracy theories are just sort of, well, are wrong in the sense that the vast majority of conspiracies that I know about, you know, are the conspiracies that are out there in the open for everybody to see, and everybody realizes that they're there, and so, like, for example, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Federal Reserve Board, the Trilateral Commission, you know, the Bilderbergers, you know, I mean, we can go on and on and on and on and on. You realize that, you know, that there's sort of an ecological relationship between these groups and the way things get done. And so the other thing is that in cases like the Federal Reserve Board, I mean, which is responsible for our money system in the United States, certain amounts of the elite institutions actually perform some positive functions from time to time. And so it's not all evil in terms of some of the things that these elite institutions do. You know, I think the thing is that a lot of times they sort of are a sieve that is a very selective sort of filter that sort of limits access in terms of making decisions or in terms of the way things get done. And these are oftentimes really more for the convenience and the ease of accomplishing things that might have to be done otherwise through more difficult democratic processes, for example. But don't you know, think of them as these shadowy overlords that control all the aspects of our lives, because in fact, you know, a lot of times if you're looking at Janet Yellen talking about, you know, monetary policy and the need to have the Federal Reserve at some point in time gradually raise its interest rates, this is like, well, you can't get more plain than that. I mean, what you see is what you get. And right. And so, you know, people, you know, these powerful organizations like the Federal Reserve, for example, which is a great case to use, you know, are oftentimes like, well, number one, they do things that are outside of the purview of anybody else just because of the position that they're in.
Right.
And just because that they do those functions doesn't prevent you as an individual citizen from doing things to, you know, that may ultimately counter some of their goals and intentions. I mean, we're still living in many respects in a democratic society. And so, you know, I can't emphasize strongly enough how important citizen action, particularly at the community level, is in terms of fighting, you know, not only the conspiracy theorists and the elite organizations that are doing all this stuff, but to me, people who believe in conspiracy theories tend to lose some personal political power, because if all, in fact, elites are all powerful, all knowing, that means that you as an individual are powerless. And that is totally false.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. That's just one way of looking at conspiracy theories, though. And I think you probably realize that's not what I meant when I used the term.
Right.
A conspiracy is two or more people acting in concert to create a pull off a criminal act, and these happen
right.
all the time. These happen in politics, and these happen among very powerful people. They collude to avoid or to break the law. They pass what are pretty clearly unconstitutional laws. For instance, sometimes like the NDAA, it's
right.
complete obliteration of the Fourth Amendment. Yet they do it, and it's pseudo-legal because the people in power are the ones that did it. Now, that is a conspiracy. There are other
right.
conspiracies that we can only infer. I mentioned the Kennedy assassination. Just because I say he was killed as a result of a conspiracy, I'm not saying that just based on a few isolated facts. There are people who have studied this and come to that conclusion. Now,
right.
I had one of them on the show before, James Douglas. He wrote JFK and the Unspeakable, probably the definitive book so far on making the case that there was a conspiracy. And really, it wasn't so much about who did it or even how, but why he was killed. And when you have that motive and you know that people have access to do it, you don't have to say exactly who did it to conclude there was a conspiracy. I mean, the House
right.
Select Committee on Assassinations concluded there was a conspiracy. And yet you bring it up and people say, oh, conspiracy theorists. That's abuse of the term. And this is all relevant to this discussion about the CIA, because it turns out that during the House Select Committee on Assassinations, when they were looking at the Warren Commission evidence about the JFK assassination and a bunch of evidence that wasn't presented there, the New York Times got a memo from the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act. It was a CIA memo sent out to their contacts in the media, telling them, use this term conspiracy theorist as a way to smear anybody who questions the conclusions of the Warren Commission.
Right,
so,
and
this
and
is one of their propaganda
really,
questions.
Right. Personally, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of the JFK assassination, because, you know, this is really an important component, you know, of all the things that I see that have gone wrong in the United States. I mean, in many respects, we kind of lost our country on November 22nd, 1963, just because that people in the FBI and the CIA, you know, and elsewhere, came to the consensus that John F. Kennedy was a viable target for assassination. And they
mm-hmm.
implemented that very well, and they destroyed any evidence that will keep anybody from coming to any total 100%, you know, proof that Agent X or Agent Y or whoever was involved in the assassination. I guess, you know, in terms of the CIA and its involvement in the Kennedy assassination, if you walk in into a house, right, and there's some guy standing over a dead body and he's got a smoking gun in his hands, you know, yeah, there might be some circumstantial evidence that says, well, you know, he didn't really kill this person. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of evidence that says, well, yeah, this guy, in fact, did this. And there,
that's
Douglas,
why they call it a smoking gun.
Yeah, as Douglas demonstrates in his book, you know, there were a whole bunch of people in the intelligence services that, you know, were very culpable for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, for just to give you a couple of names, you know, James Lee Angleton, okay? James Angleton should be as well known as Lee Harvey Oswald, but Angleton was the head of the counterintelligence branch of the CIA, and many people think that he was in part the mastermind behind the assassination of Kennedy. Similarly, James Atlee Phillips should be known just as much as Lee Harvey Oswald as an assassin of Kennedy. David Attlee Phillips was a pathogenic liar, basically, even within the agency. And, you know, so anything that he said or anything that he did was like 100% untrustworthy. And yet, you know, he's like one of those people where you say, oh, gee, what are you doing with that smoking gun in your hand? Because wherever you look in terms of the details behind the assassination of Kennedy, there is the name of David Attlee Phillips.
I don't want to get too off on this, but I agree with you, and I just recommend that people go and read JFK and the Unspeakable or go to our podcast file at SFPI Radio, as in Soldiers for Peace International, SFPI Radio. You can get our podcast files for all of these shows, and JFK and the Unspeakable is one of those shows. Great episode. But I don't want to get too lost in this, Carl, because mostly I want to talk about what the CIA is actually authorized to do. That was a black op. That was not authorized. It wasn't the director of the CIA calling it. And you called Angleton, I think it was, a mastermind. And, yeah, he probably put together the logistics, but he isn't the one that ordered the hit. You said, it's probably some people just got together, powerful enough people, and said, this guy's got to go. I mean, lots of people were saying that. Very powerful people were saying that publicly. But we don't need to get in too much into the details of how these conspiracies work. Let's just face it, they exist. Let's go on, though, to the basic functions of the CIA. So when they were created, they were supposed to be an intelligence agency. And we see that even that function has been perverted because we have had vice presidents running around cherry picking and basically ordering what kind of reports they want. And fortunately, there are decent people in the CIA who've challenged that from time to time. They stopped the first Iran war in 2006 that Cheney had planned. Now they're beating the drums again. But everybody knows he was cherry-picking data to support the idea that we needed to go to war against Saddam Hussein, which every argument they used turned out to be a lie. So that was an abuse of the CIA intelligence function. Now, it's my understanding that there are like 17 different intelligence agencies in the United States. Do we really need a CIA for intelligence functions? I mean, do they...
That's a really good question, and you know, basically, you've got a lot of questions and a lot of things embedded in there. The first thing I want to say is that, you know, the examination of the CIA in terms of its role in assassination and destabilization of countries and the assassination of individuals sort of has to be put into the historical context of the Church Commission, for one thing.
Carl, I'm going to interrupt you here. I want to get to all that, but I want to break it down for people. Right now, just comment, if you can, on the intelligence function, not the covert operations.
Okay, that's good. Well, you know, the thing is Daniel Patrick Monahan, who was the senator of New York, and I think he was on the National Security Council with the Nixon administration, one time in the late 70s called for the abolition of the CIA. And one of the reasons that one of the cases that can be made for the abolition of the CIA as it's currently formed is the fact that we have now so much information that's open source information available on the Internet that if you went back to the original functions of what the CIA was established for, I am sort of like my own one-man CIA in the fact that I have 30 or more, you know, news subscription things, news sources that I go to on a regular basis, and not including, you know, the specialized sources of information that I can go to. And, you know, it's possible to find out just about anything in the world right now as far as some of the big intelligence questions, you know, that countries face. You know, what is the intention possibly of Russia regarding Afghanistan or the Ukraine, for example? Okay, none of that is really secret. If you look at enough sources, you can put together the mosaics of the, you know, the pieces of the mosaic, and you can get a picture of actually where Russia is headed in terms of the directions that it's going. Now, contrast that with legitimate classified information, right? And so if I ask you, all right, in what town in Anbar province are the special forces going to make a raid at 3 o'clock in the morning today? That's like really classified information, and, you know, revealing that information could potentially jeopardize lives in a national security situation.
Isn't that something, Carl, you're getting to my point. Isn't that something the Defense Intelligence Agency could handle, for instance?
Yes, and this is the interesting thing, is that because of the way the CIA is, it was particularly after the Bush and Cheney regime, they began to load up the intelligence agency with these ideologues. And so if you are a senator, okay, and you want to find out what's the situation in Lebanon, for example, or the situation in Syria, and you get a CIA briefing, you kind of have to take your snake bite kit with you, because there's going to be a certain amount of ideology that's just sort of salted in to a supposedly objective report of the situation in Syria, for example. I'll give you a classic case in point. I had a conversation with Senator Wyden from Oregon, and I told him that I felt that really the Russians needed to step up to the plate and take a more active role in terms of dealing with the situation in Syria, and that the United States should step back. And Wyden started spouting the usual Washington, D.C. hawk ideology. Mm-hmm. And I rolled my eyes and I just said, look, I asked for a DIA briefing, not a CIA briefing, a Defense Intelligence Agency briefing. The people in the DIA, in my opinion, have actually much less of an ideological axe to grind in terms of situations, military situations, and other situations threatening national security than the CIA does. I think all you have to do is to look at, you know, our misbegotten policies in the Ukraine, for example, and you realize that, you know, one of the problems that we're having with this horrible decision-making that we're doing in the Ukraine is really based on the fact that you have, you know, various neocon hardliners in the National Security Council and the CIA that are bending the agenda. And so there are lots of other sources of information in the United States that are better than the CIA at this point.
Well, I definitely see your point there, and it brings me to another issue. And we, you know, contrasting CIA, DIA, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, is associated with the military, and you would hope military people take into account the effects of their decisions on the troops in the field, whereas arguably CIA analysts who haven't necessarily ever experienced war might not do that, especially if they're ideologues. So maybe that's a good reason to have the DIA handling that stuff. But instead, we've gone the opposite way. Now, during the Bush administration, according to the book Legacy of Ashes, the CIA became militarized. I mean, director after director came out of the military, and high-ranking officials in the CIA are out of the military, many of whom, by the way, go from there to become private security contractors or whatever, making millions of dollars off of their connections in the so-called defense industry, the weapons industry, the security industry. What I'm saying is it seems to me that the functions of the CIA and the military, the Pentagon, have merged in a lot of ways. Drone programs, that's another way. And then, of course, we have this overlap in intelligence functions. The CIA has their own – they actually have their own army in a way. I mean, it was a CIA battalion leading the charge in Afghanistan in 2001. What is with this? Do we really need a whole separate almost army that's unaccountable to anybody? The CIA
I think you have to put this, again, into the historical context of what was going on. And so many of our problems currently, you know, regarding the national security state revolve around the events of 9/11 and what happened afterwards. I talked to people in the defense industry who called, the fearsome foursome of, you know, Rumsfeld, Condi Rice, Bush and Cheney, the presidents. And in other words, you know, it was the Bush White House was composed so much of a gang that couldn't shoot straight and did exactly the wrong things in terms of the way to pursue, you know, terrorism after 9/11. We're still suffering from that horribly today, and that is really worth talking about.
Well, that's true, and I think it's important. Again, this is not a partisan show. I think it's important to note that very little has changed except for a few things that have gotten worse, such as NDAA didn't pass till Obama was in office, and so that gives the president the right to declare any American citizen an enemy combatant and throw them in prison indefinitely without charges, a military prison. You know, that's kind of worse than Bush in a way. Scarier, you know, as far
yeah,
as
I mean, you know, I'm not going to defend the president's track record on human rights or the NDAA at all. However, you know, one of the things about being a president is that, well, Bill Clinton describes the president of the United States as being the manager of Forest Lawn in Los Angeles. You've got tens of thousands of people who, you know, you're over and you supervise, but none of them really bother too much to communicate with you. And
right.
So if you have a whole series of laws that are already enacted, you know, as much as somebody, giving Obama whatever break I could, which I probably shouldn't, but I'm just saying that given what he had to work with, you know, he didn't have a particularly large degree of freedom in terms of how he was going to be able to implement some of those laws that had already been adopted. And we go back to 9/11, where, you know, we had the buildings crash, and there was this panic among the entire world, the entire United States, about what should be pursued. And there were some people that had things in their file cabinet that were ready to go that idiots in Washington, D.C. implemented. And America today is horribly crippled in terms of our intelligence structure, our ungainly, unwieldy intelligence structure, the fact that, you know, as many as 60% of all intelligence personnel now are not even public employees. They're private contractors. And
right.
You say, okay, so where do you get public responsibility or accountability when you have, like, private businessmen being actively involved in the intelligence decision-making process, and B, no audit trail from either the CIA or the Defense Department to call some of these banditos to call for what they have done in terms of siphoning off federal taxpayers' money. I mean, you talk about fraud, waste, and abuse. There is absolutely no department of the United States of America government that is more fraud, more waste, and more abuse than the Defense Department, and that includes the CIA, obviously, and the NSA. You know, the Congress and the president are slowly backing away from this, but unfortunately it might take 10 years to get out of this legal sort of monstrosity that we're in with Homeland Security. And in the meantime, you know, there's not going to be anything to happen as far as the United States is, except that the structure will impose continuing damage on our ability to cope as a society, as a country, as a participant in the world.
Well, I agree with you that the system is the problem, Carl, but and I'm not about, you know, laying blame on people, but you still have to hold them responsible. The president had plenty of opportunity to be a leader and call for these changes. He can't change them by himself, no, but he can call for changes. He could have called for the revocation, just letting the Patriot Act expire. And what does he do? He lobbies for it. He lobbies for TPP, which is another way that corporations are trying to, international, transnational corporations are trying to gain power over governments. He lobbied for NDAA, and he argued with Carl Levine that it should include Americans. I'm sorry, you can't give him a pass on this just because the system sucks. That's
why
we elect presidents.
There's a huge amount of blame that can go around to President Obama for his conduct as far as the way he handled the national security state. You know, my take on the thing is that to some extent there's a amount of capital that a president has to spend, okay, in terms of his personal power in Washington, D.C. And after you get through spending that personal capital, you know, you're sort of like a figurehead. You're the little man on the wedding cake. And so Obama basically decided to do other things than serious national intelligence reform. And all of that is to his discredit. And sort of like what I've heard about what Obama said at one point in time in a dinner party that he had with somebody, was they asked him, well, why aren't you doing more, you know, to do this, you know, fight this military-industrial complex monster? And Obama at the dinner party basically said, well, you know, I don't want to wind up like JFK. So this is one of those things that people worry about.
Just a slight correction, Carl. It was Martin Luther King. But to our listeners, I want you to know this is not just a rumor. Ray McGovern is a former CIA analyst, now quite active in the anti-war movement, and he had this a firsthand witness spoke to him about this. So that's the certainty we have. This actually happened. It wasn't just a rumor. So Obama is afraid of assassination. By the way, McGovern said, but he's a coward if he lets that determine his actions. I leave that to the individual to decide. I personally understand why a man with a wife and two beautiful young children might not want to get his head blown off trying to help a country that doesn't seem to care enough to learn about these facts. I can understand that. I'm not going to judge the man. That's not my job. Nobody's job as far as I'm concerned. But we do have to acknowledge that he did not take that opportunity, whatever the reason. Now, Carl, I'm going to cut you off there because we need to talk about some other stuff that we – was actually on the agenda here.
about the
CIA specifically. So I mentioned that one of the most important things that people don't know about is the propaganda function of the CIA. Let me just lay out a little background for our listeners here. In around 1950, in addition to its job of subverting governments and conducting assassinations and eventually sponsoring insurgencies and whatnot, the CIA was given the specific duty of propagandizing, not in the United States, that's illegal actually, but propagandizing in friendly countries, not just enemy countries. This is a bit of a shift in the official duties of the CIA. So they were authorized to propagandize in the American interests in Europe as well as in the former Soviet Union, wherever they could, buy a Voice of America or something like that, Radio Free Europe, all these things. They were authorized to propagandize. In other words, they didn't have to tell the truth. They just had to say what would serve American interests, which, as we've said often on this show, is defined as the interests of transnational corporations that control American foreign policy. So that was an official job. It was called Operation Mockingbird, which makes it sound like it was some temporary thing. But it wasn't, because the CIA had already established contacts with New York Times, Time Magazine, and a lot of other major publications, and they were already propagandizing here, clear back to the Office of Strategic Services before the CIA. I mean, it was the same people who started the CIA. But anyway, the point is, so they are circulating false and misleading stories in Europe and in the United States under Operation Mockingbird. Carl, you mentioned a couple of operations that occurred around that time, the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Guatemala, and later Mossadegh in Iran. Those were two coups that the CIA had a heavy hand in, but the American people didn't know it because everything that we read was basically based on press releases from that were approved by the CIA.
Right. Well,
is that,
I mean,
is that your understanding?
Yeah, that is, yes, and it's very interesting to stop and think about this because, you know, one of the things that we learned, you know, as a government over time about these so-called quick and easy overthrows of Guatemala and Iran is that once we did that, we permanently destroyed the democracy as it was before in both of those countries. And in the long term, we created a lot more problems for ourselves because of the legacies of these overthrows, of these coup d'etats that we instituted. You know, the problem of massacres of the Mayan population still continues today in Guatemala, and all you have to do is look at the Ayatollahs and say, well, you can draw a direct line, you know, from the Ayatollahs to our overthrow of Mossadegh in 1950. And so for a long time, you know, the United States was out of that business so much. They reduced the level of the intensity of organizing coups the way they might have done, say, particularly in the 1960s. But, you know, with the Bush administration, again, and its involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, I like what Pepe Escobar says about our American foreign policy right now. He calls it the empire of chaos. And because we're a declining empire, we're kind of like thrashing out and throwing wild punches that miss on things. And so there's a tendency for us to create more damage. And basically, the United States is seen by many people in the world as the rogue state right now. And you know, all I have to do is just say, how has our Middle Eastern policy been working out for us lately? And, you know, the answer is not so good. But, you know, I mean, the way things get done in Washington, D.C. with lobbyists, let's go and talk about the blowjobs for billionaires culture that we have in the nation's capital, the defense contracts that are lucrative and ongoing forever. You know, you have all sorts of things that are channelizing the way we do things nationally and at home. I mean, internationally and at home. And it gets extremely difficult. It gets extremely difficult to get out of that mode of operation. It's almost like, you know, America government is sort of hooked on the narcotic of military contracts and government contracts in general.
Well,
and
let me just say, that there is partly it's self-perpetuating, but there is a logic to it also. We had Ellen Brown on here a few months ago talking about the imminent crash of the dollar. The dollar's backed not by gold but by petroleum. So there's a very important reason they're trying to control the Mideast and cut Russia out. Russia's a major player in Mideast gas, at least, less oil. They have their own oil fields and gas fields too, but they also and they're a big part of that whole complex of natural gas that starts out in the Persian Gulf. That's what the game's about, because if we truly had to compete on a level playing field, if we didn't have a military destroying governments that might develop their economies and actually compete with American or American-associated transnational corporations in the oil and gas industry, there's nothing backing up the dollar. And that's one of the main reasons that we're seeing this craziness. This is why they're going, they've always wanted to take over the world, but this is why they're going crazy right now and doing all this nonsense at once.
Well, yeah, I'll be honest with you. I think we have some disagreements potentially in terms of the way we see the world economic system going. I don't want to talk about that right now. But
okay.
The way I look at the situation is that, you know, first of all, I have described the CIA in the past. It's not James Bond. There's like one out of every 10,000 or 100,000 employees of the CIA who might do some kind of James Bond thing, okay? But if you wanted an adequate description of what the CIA actually is and does, think about a combination of the U.S. Post Office, the telephone company, and like United Airlines, okay, or UPS. UPS is a better example. And these are very mundane functions. And so the national security establishment is basically a giant collection of bureaucracies. We have 17, individual intelligence bureaucracies right now, thanks to our reorganization, into Homeland Security, and a lot of people in the intelligence community just can do nothing but complain about this horrible monstrosity of a bureaucratic monster that we have right now. I mean, our intelligence capabilities are actually far below, what they were a long time ago in the 60s or the 40s or even in the late 70s, because we have so many layers of useless bureaucracies, so many layers of private contractors, sucking up resources. And, mm-hmm. and so stepping away from the system is a long-term process. The problem is that the American empire is basically reaching the limits of its reach right now, and we're all almost in the process of overreach in terms of where we're going. Whether you want to look at the Middle East, you want to look at the Ukraine, you want to look at the TPP, okay, all of these things are indications that the system that we have in place in Washington, D.C., A, is not working, and B, things are beginning to break down. And my contention is that, in the arc of empire, the breakdown and decay of these intelligence infrastructures is just one of the things that, will be an issue of sustainability. At some point in time, yes, the whole economy will collapse. The whole economy could have a horrible setback at any point in time right now, either with the Chinese stock market bubble or with the issue of the Greeks and the European Union, among two things. And so, the Death Star economy, yes, has everything to do with the way the CIA functions and national security state functions. I guess the bad thing is that we won't be able to dismantle, the intelligence agencies or the excess defense bureaucracy until it's very late in the process. The only way of dismantling these agencies, as far as I can see, is to have such a severe budgetary crisis, where the United States is so strapped with cash, where you may have the collapse of the world economic order, that, the United States is left with no choice except to throw some of these defense contractors overboard. My prospects in terms of getting rid of the agency or getting rid of the whole aspect of private contracting alone, I'm very pessimistic about it, even in the long run. But in the medium run, but in the long run, you're absolutely right. The whole house of cards will fall, and at that point in time, maybe we'll go on to a better society.
Well, I think the only way that it's going to change sooner is if we educate people about what CIA is really about, and that was the intention of this show. I haven't heard anything to convince me that it's actually necessary. You say they have a lot of mundane functions. Okay, fine. With 16 other intelligence agencies, I imagine they could divvy it up more efficiently. But what we don't need, and this is really the main issue, what we don't need is an agency – I don't care if it's only one out of 1,000, the people that do the dirty deeds are unaccountable. We've talked
right.
about how they work with the mafia. They work with drug smugglers. They work with terrorists. They work with paramilitary hit squads in South and
they
Central
America. They work with Al-Qaeda.
They work with Al-Qaeda. They work there's evidence that they work with ISIS.
Right.
They work with rogue states. They are unaccountable. I mean,
the worst people in the world, Rick.
We don't even know if the president knows what they're doing, and we sure as hell don't. Why don't we know if the president knows what we're doing? Because of a little thing called plausible deniability. When they do
right.
something, it can't be traced back to the president. So we never know what the president knew. After Iran-Contra, Reagan said over and over he didn't have anything to do with it. I'm not sure if we ever found a smoking gun to connect him to that, but I believe the evidence did show that Reagan knew in advance, and he had to apologize. Isn't that right, or did I get that wrong?
Actually, I mean, the take on it is by that point in time, Ronald Reagan may have been moderately into his Alzheimer's disease. And so when he got on the stand...
Long before that, unless he was already moderately into it when he's elected.
Yeah, they were thinking about invoking the Presidential Order of Secession Act sometime in his first term, actually. And then they decided to keep Reagan on as this sort of figurehead, and they just sort of managed around him. And so Oliver North, you know, and Poindexter were in many respects the architects of all the bad things that happened with Iran-Contra, for example.
Well, and let's not forget that Vice President George H.W. Bush was CIA director just a few years before that, so he was he knew all these players, let's say.
And
he was
like the vice president. He was the vice president under Reagan, the man who supposedly had Alzheimer's, and he somehow claimed that he was not in the loop. And you go,
right.
Well, how does that work? You know?
Maybe it was Nancy and her astrologer doing all the decision making.
Well,
right?
That's enough. Yeah, I mean, yeah, but again, it's kind of like, you know, the handiwork of the Bushes. You know, they've left dirty fingerprints. I don't know, since Prescott Bush was cozy with Adolf Hitler. You know, so
well,
it's kind of like.
That's a big topic we're not going to be able to get into, but I do recommend people look up that connection. Prescott Bush was a senator, and he was also a large stockholder in a corporation.
Brown,
that
Root Harriman.
Right. Did business with IG Farben, which was illegal at the time because they were a big industry in Nazi Germany, and it violated the Trading with the Enemy Act. He also... worked for, I'm not sure, Harriman was a banking/financial institution, if I'm not mistaken. And at any rate, I know he was a banker. And they were involved early on in financing Hitler's rise to power. Now, does that mean he was in on that? I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is they had a vested interest in making money off Germany, whether or not there was a war going on. And even while his son was flying in a very dangerous job as a bomber pilot in World War II. But before the war, there was also something called the businessman plot, where Smedley Butler, Major General Smedley Butler, 3-star, highly decorated Marine Corps general, testified before Congress that certain businessmen had approached him to organize a military plot to take down Roosevelt. Now, this is a matter of public record. You can even look up his speech on YouTube. people forget about this. And by the way, what did Congress do about it? Nothing. Because of the power of the people behind it. They didn't want to mess with them. Now, I can't say that Prescott Bush was one of them, but there's every reason to look at his circle of friends, if not him. And then we see him consorting with Nazis later on. I mean, and then his son becomes president, and his son becomes president. Something is seriously, now we've got his other grandson running for president. Something is seriously amiss here. People need to look at these things. It's not conspiracy theory. These are facts. Ask yourself.
Yeah, this is stuff out in the open. Absolutely.
And he was involved with the CIA. And look at the book, Family of Secrets. And there's a lot more to this story I can't go into here because we're supposed to be talking just about CIA.
Okay. Well, but, you know, I mean, again, it's sort of like I have to be sort of, yeah, pessimistic about the prospects of doing any kind of long-term intelligence reform on the other, in terms of a citizens initiative. On the other hand, you know, I see the intelligence community trying to take steps to correct some of the situations. And if you look at the wiretapping of the NSA on, you know, all public citizens, you know, all citizens of the United States, that was voted down. And it was voted down in part because, you know, you had a conflict within the NSA and the national security bureaucracy. On the one hand, you had the bureaucrats who wanted to maintain the government contracts collecting the information on every citizen in the United States because they liked their budget. In other words, they were acting like bureaucrats, and they were not acting in the interest of the nation. On the other hand, there's an army of intelligence professionals, including a couple of whistleblowers, who were outraged at the fraud, waste, and abuse in terms of the collection program on citizen information. And they came time and time again to their superiors, to members of Congress, to anybody that would listen to them. And they said, look, okay, it is absolutely ridiculous, you know, to keep tabs on how much grandma buys toilet paper at Walmart. You don't need to do this. This is not, you know, contributing to national security interests. We can do things much better, much smaller, much less cost, and much more effectively. And the argument in terms of doing things effectively and when all else fails, use common sense, is one of those things that Washington, D.C. might begin to appear to be doing right now.
If I can interject here, you're talking about the Thomas Drake story for one thing. I encourage people to look that up. It's complicated. But, yeah, absolutely. There was a program they spent years developing that would have protected people's privacy much better than what they ended up with. And it was almost perfected. They recommended adopting it. It was called Thin Thread. And then all of a sudden some competitor who was politically connected came up with another system which was not protective of people's privacy. It was defective in a number of ways. And as you said, he tried to bring it up to the people, and he ended up getting punished for it. He's a whistleblower.
Exactly.
And that has continued through the Obama administration. He's used the Espionage Act more than all presidents before him put together. This is a mess. And I would say, I want to go on. Let me just say that the reforms of the Patriot Act were minuscule. All that data is still being collected. It's just being collected by the phone companies. And they can get at it anytime they want because we still have phone. Carl, running out of time here. I'm not even sure where to go from here. There are some positive things that are going on, though, and you and I are going to talk about those in a future show. I just want to make one more point here before I sign off, and that is you said it earlier in the show. At the root of all this is corruption. So, no, we cannot take down the CIA directly. That's a symptom of the larger problem. If we can deal with corruption in the U.S. government, that's how we can begin to dismantle the military-industrial complex. That's all we have time for, Carl. Wanted to give you the last word, but my timing's off again. But we'll have you back on soon.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick.
Thank you. Talk to you then. That's it for this week on Taking Back America.